papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Now, welcome to the Media Project, an inside look at media coverage of current events. Hi, I'm Judy Patrick. I am not Rex Smith, but I'm the former editor of the Daily Gazette. Filling in for Rex today with us, Barb Lombardo, former editor of the Saratogian and now an adjunct professor at the University of Albany, as well as WAMC host and producer of this fine program, and you, Albany adjunct professor. You're all teaching the kids, aren't you? David Gustina, thank you all for being with us.
Lucky you. You get me today from the bench.
You know, as Rex does, I'm going to ask you all, what do you want to talk about, Barb?
Boy, there's a lot, including the elections, which we should talk about today. But I'd also like to talk about the CBS interview, the 60 Minutes interview with Trump, and what this all means to the future of believability of news.
Hey, and what's on your mind, Dave?
Well, you know, we responded to a letter last week about the fact that why didn't journalists know more about the demolition of the East Wing of the White House? This week, I want to know why the White House is now restricting media access to the West Wing.
All good topics. You know, let's begin by talking about the legacy media's treatment of Zoran Mamdani and his successful bid for mayor of New York City. I was amazed at the treatment both in legacy print and online. It kind of began for me when the New York Times, in its effort not to endorse in local races, again, a bad decision, but what they did was they essentially non-endorsed him before the June primary. And following up with that, there have been headline after headline that discuss his win as improbable, his candidacy always being very critical in a way that I'm surprised by. Hamilton Nolan in the Columbia Journalism Review made some really great points, and he talked about the stunning unity of the papers in their opposition to the possibility that Mamdani may represent something positive is indicative of what all these publications have in common. More than any other media outlet, great old papers like these represent the establishment. Being part of the political, social, and economic power structure defined the nature of successful big city papers and their owners for generations. And as he makes the point, they're worried about that. I mean, did you think what they have been doing has been fair towards this new mayor of New York City?
Well, I don't know about fair, but I will bring up an old name who created this program, Dr. Alan Chartok. And he used to say this all the time to Rex Smith, who would poo-poo it. But when you read the New York Times, you know that they are part of the establishment. And this kind of non-endorsement is what proves it. What I love is that our columnist here wrote, "It's easy to imagine the Journal, the Times, and the Post as three nervous suburbanites on a day trip to New York City, purses clutched tight to their sides, their hands grasping pepper spray as they descend into the threatening depths of the Times Square subway station." You know, that to me is so very accurate, a wonderful, colorful metaphor for how these papers operate. They're afraid of change. They don't like change, and they push back at it.
Yeah, they don't want to give up their power, which they are abdicating anyway by being out of touch with youth, the future, and other points of view. It was not surprising, but disappointing.
You know, I was also disappointed in the CNN commentary after on election night and the day after election, where they were very critical of Mamdani's speech, saying it went too far. He was too aggressive. He was not conciliatory enough. It was like, and it was almost a universal opinion. Wherever you went elsewhere, you heard different kinds of opinions, like this is strong, this is forceful, this is the kind of enthusiasm that the voters are craving.
I mean, as opposed to what? The president of the United States, Elise Stefanik from New York, lying, basically, misinformation, calling the guy a communist and a jihadist.
Right. And I think the New York Times follow-up editorial was one where they outlined his to-do list, which included, they were going to score him. They've given him objectives to reach. That seemed a little condescending as well, but I'm sure their hearts were in the right place.
Yeah, there were opportunities for the legacy media to explain to the public what a democratic socialist means.
Yes.
Instead, I feel like most of the coverage was just expressing fears about socialism and radical leftism and anti-Semitism, which I don't think fit into his narrative if you really looked at what he was saying and what he was doing. It's kind of crazy.
Well, perhaps the most interesting thing to me about what happened here was that despite this establishment media and the way they approached this race, Zohran Mamdani understood the other part of the media ecosystem that we're having a hard time conquering as traditional media people. And that's social media and his accounts there and how he reached out to a huge coalition of young people and basically did a run around the traditional press and won.
And do you remember the New York Times, as a, for instance, treating Bernie Sanders, who is a democratic socialist, the same way they're treating Mamdani when he was a candidate for president?
Right. That didn't hit home with me. I didn't remember that as well either. They really do have to take a hard look at what they did in the past and how they're going to treat this administration going forward. Let's give them a chance and see what the establishment media does. It's their opportunity to show that they can look beyond their biases.
I think it's also the opportunity for the legacy media to analyze the election results and report more broadly the results nationwide in other races, in the gubernatorial races, in other seats that went to Democrats and women.
Yeah.
So there were some groundbreaking elections. And are they just going to be focusing on the hand-wringing about Mamdani?
The one thing that we have as responsibilities, too, and I think we all do this, is when there is a political race and we hear these victory speeches and the acceptance speeches, we're listening very carefully to what they're saying. So, for example, former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who has been hammering Mamdani throughout this election, leaning into a lot of what the Republicans were saying negatively about Mamdani, especially when it came to being anti-Semitic. And yet I have never heard him so gracious in my entire life when he gave his speech going against his own crowd saying, no, 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 do not bash him, do not boo. We're going to work together to make the city better. And I'm listening as a journalist going, what position is he trying to get?
He just wants to be able to play in the sandbox.
Right? I mean, isn't that part of what we should be doing?
Right.
Getting those clues?
Right. And asking everyone the important questions that need to be asked before an election and after an election, and not just say, okay, it's over, let's move on. I think, for example, Chuck Schumer, I think people asked him, why didn't you endorse the Democratic candidate? And I think too many reporters just let him walk away from that question.
Good point.
So speaking of legacy media, let's talk a little bit about that 60 Minutes interview with Donald Trump by Nora O'Donnell. Did she do a good job? Did she hold his feet to the fire like they needed to be held?
Barbara?
I think all things considered with the constraints upon her, she did a pretty good job. And yet I think she fell short because there were too many opportunities to push back about what he was saying. You know, he's not going to answer. Although she did interrupt him occasionally, she can interrupt him, and I don't know for what end. It just, the whole thing is so ridiculous. CBS paid off the president and agreed to, after the Kamala Harris interview in the lawsuit, saying, oh, yeah, we're not going to edit these shows, and everybody's going to get to say what they want to say, no problem. And so what happens? His interview is heavily edited. So the idiotic, inane non sequiturs, the ramblings get sane-washed to an extent. You know, CBS paid, what was it, $16 million to get the president off their back?
For something all journalists do when they put stories together, they leave something on the editing room floor.
And here they were editing heavily so that the president didn't seem like a total idiot.
You know, this was the first since David Ellison's company took over CBS, and it also should be noted it was the first interview Trump has had with 60 Minutes since Barry Weiss was named editor-in-chief of CBS. One of the things I noticed is that in an interview like that, Nora O'Donnell is trying to hit too many subjects. That's why she doesn't do the deep dives. Why don't they just stick to immigration, for example? Why do we need to touch all the bases in 30 or 35 minutes?
That seems, because they don't know when he's going to come back.
Yeah, I know, but they did make some news with some of the things he said.
Especially him doubling down on things.
And not knowing the answers to some questions like the name of the person that he pardoned and what he did. I mean,
not only didn't know the name, you know, it was one of those, never heard of them, you know, I don't know, my kids are this and that, that, that. She did do a good job because she threw that in as an unexpected question and he couldn't answer it, or his answer was frightening.
I mean, you work in audio. I mean, it is hard to interview someone in a limited amount of time, especially when they have a new rule that, you know, you can't edit me. What do you do then?
Right. I mean, I think this is so unique because the last time there was a 60 Minutes interview with him, he got up and walked out of the room.
That was with Leslie Stahl?
That's right. And you have to believe that Nora O'Donnell had that in the back of her mind, where I'm not going to let everything go, but I want to keep him here long enough to get a bunch of these questions in while we have him. He has come up with a really great strategy, and it's been working for him, including getting him money in lawsuits. But what I loved was when, and I agree with Barbara, 1,000%, there are parts of that that I liked, and then there are parts of it I was screaming, saying, why aren't you challenging him on this? Now, the good thing was that when he kept going off about the ACA and healthcare costs and all this, she finally said, where's your plan? Where is your plan? Because the Republicans have not had a plan. They just keep blasting the Democrats. Now, he didn't respond to that in any way or accept that they didn't have a plan, but she had to ask the question, and she did.
You know, as much as I love Nora O'Donnell and I love 60 Minutes and I had a great fondness for the legacy of CBS, I would love it if this man would sit down with a print reporter, someone who could really spend some time with him and ask him questions that we want asked. And he just doesn't do that. And it needs to be done. I mean, Joe Biden didn't do it either. I'm very critical of that. But these kind of broadcasts are his forte. And let's hope that he decides to sit down. But I don't think there's any. Maybe he'll sit down with the Washington Post.
Yeah,
maybe,
or the Wall Street Journal's editorial board. He'll do that.
Hey, you know, we don't get very many letters, but we got one this week. What did our letter writer have to say about our esteemed product we produced last week?
I don't know if you're going to like it, but I can't read the whole thing because it's long, and it comes from a guy named Robert, and he is taking a journalism class, and your program is a requirement.
Really?
What the, I don't even require
Barb,
my students to do that.
Barb, are you
It's not you, right, Barb?
No, but that would a great idea.
Not to say anything derogatory, but my teacher finds value in the media project, so here I am. I love that. Now, his analysis of one of our programs, this was last week. First of all, he criticized that I somehow forgot to put the new dates in. So that's on me. But he said what he calls women in the window journalism. And we'll see how you react to that.
I'm not liking it already.
This is where we have different journalists reporting on problems, but never do anything about the issues they divulge. My problem with this is that it can condition listeners, viewers, and readers into the same behavior. If everything is practicing activism from the window, nothing will be effectively addressed. Like I think Barbara said, she will alert those to their error with a note. This may seem like boots-on-the-ground activism, but I don't think so. Unless follow-up and accountability, those emails and notes wind up in the shredder. Thanks, Robert. Hope the class goes well.
Well, Robert, there's a thing called solutions journalism, which is considered something of a fad, but and it's an approach to writing a story where you attack a big issue and you bring to your coverage people who are working to address the problem. You know, ways that the drug crisis might be resolved, or ways that people can help people who are dealing with a cut in food stamps. That's called solutions journalism. And it's a major undertaking. It takes a lot of resources to do, but it's definitely something that we strive for in some cases. It can't be every story, though.
We also can't solve anything here in a roundtable panel discussion each week on the Media Project. We can only point to the things that are happening in the media, try to offer what we think could be solutions, but what more can we really do?
Can we do anything, Barb?
Oh, boy. What can we do? I think that as citizens, we need to stay on top of our media outlets and let them know what we think. And I think using our own social media presence, our own friends, our voices, to tell people what we think needs to be done and to hold media to account as best we can.
You know, as a reporter, I used to think that I was writing into a black hole and no one was responding or no action was being taken. But it sometimes does happen. Sometimes you can write a story that will result in new legislation or someone being helped or people coming to the rescue of someone in need. You can generate change, But it doesn't happen all the time. And for especially for journalists new to the enterprise, it can be disconcerting to write this major blockbuster and then nothing happens.
By the way, Robert wrote from Auburn, New York. I want to also throw in, because you mentioned young journalists, we have a young journalist here who's just started as my producer, and she's experienced. She came from Oregon. She's actually from Queens, but she came back this way. She's working for us now. Her name is Sagina Shrestha. And this young woman is so competent with the computer and databases. So what she's doing for us right now is she did this on her own. She's looking at all the code violations that have been listed across the city of Albany. And she was able to, by using her computer, because it wasn't there and collated, she was able to get all of them with her computer doing that work. Now she's going through that list to find patterns and to see if there's certain neighborhoods or other areas where codes are constantly violated. She referenced another reporter she'd been working with where it seems that a lot of the quote-unquote slumlords or landlords who aren't taking care of their properties, this is where a lot of these happen. It's a way to identify things. It's also a way to use this ability and skill with computers and databases to produce real news. And that's not something we've had a lot of at WAMC. So there are really interesting ways to do this. I know you both know this, but for the listeners, that's exciting here at WAMC.
So that is exciting. And then going, so that's the upper. And then the downer is when, as Judy said, you present something that took a lot of work and then you don't see results, you don't get feedback. You might start change. And we've had instances where, I remember there was a story where somebody took up something that they read about and it took them, years had gone by, but then they pursued whatever it was that bugged them that they read and they made change. So you can be a catalyst for positive change.
Right. We point out the problems. We hope someone will take up the mantle and solve the problems. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes it doesn't. If you keep hammering an issue, sometimes that will provoke action. But the reality is we can only write the news.
Yeah. And what about who, the ethnicity of people who come in and report, like Miriam Ahmad, who is in our newsroom right now, who, you know, we haven't done a lot on things like Diwali or cricket that's become so popular in the capital region.
Brilliant.
Other things that we might not be thinking of because we come from this culture. Bringing in a wide diversity of people into your newsroom necessarily grows that news to a level and opens eyes and ears that have never heard about these things before.
Ah, you're talking about reality. Let's talk about non-reality.
It's everywhere.
It is. My favorite story from the week was Fox News. Their website was duped by an AI video, and then they were criticized because they didn't even own up to the fact that they got duped. What this was a story posted about SNAP beneficiaries threatening to loot stores amid the government shutdown. The original headline was SNAP beneficiaries threatened to ransack stores over government shutdown, and it quoted a woman in a video complaining about the shutdown. The problem was it was an AI generated, and it got space on a national platform. And as you know, a lot of people probably watched that and believed it. Again, the problem with AI, we have to be mindful of it. I'm seeing every week I come here, I have seen more and more dangerous AI videos, dangerous AI stories. And it's on all of us, not just us in this room. It's the people listening. It's the average person who doesn't usually pay attention to news to look at what they see and analyze it carefully before they spread it.
And more than that, they need to
tell. You can't tell.
No, it's okay, Barb, because we're both passionate about this. And the idea that you need to not only pay attention to this stuff, but you need to reach out to your lawmakers. The real problem is they're not doing anything about this at the legislative level. And they need to come up with some rules and some things that we need to do so that we can more easily identify AI. A lot of this stuff you can sort of pick out, but it's getting harder and harder. And at some point, I've got to believe we're not going to know the difference.
Well, we don't know the difference already. And when the government is using AI, as we know that they are, to falsely portray facts, then, you know, what the heck are the rest of us supposed to do? I was so, at first I thought, oh, Fox got duped, but they're going to admit that they were duped. Even if they did admit that they were duped, their listeners and viewers have already seen it. They're not going to see this little correction. And so the damage is done. I don't know that they were inadvertently duped or they didn't care, because their response at the end was that they updated to say this, you know, article appears to have been generated by AI without noting this. So they can note it, but they don't say,
we'll never use it again.
Yeah. because to them and to a lot of the public, it's reasonably representative of how they feel or what they think the truth is like. And that is not truth.
And as Judy, you pointed out last week with the, I forget, you had a certain term for it, the slop.
AI slop.
The AI slop that comes. We know human behavior. We're going to look at the car crash. We're going to look at the extreme headline. And any of those golly, Martha, as Rex would say, stories are going to drive us there before we get to the legitimate ones.
You know, I had a friend talk to me about the destruction of the East Wing of the White House, and she was convinced the first few hours she saw that was AI. Oh, that couldn't be true. You know, and so reality sometimes gets confused as well. She believed that could not possibly be true. Speaking of the White House, I hear that the reporters are being ejected from the West Wing as well as, I guess they can't go in the East Wing anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite something, really. Here it is, right in black and white. White House restricts media access in key area of the West Wing. Reporters can no longer access an area in the West Wing known as, quote, upper press that houses the office of key communication staff members, triggering pushback from White House correspondents who said the move would hurt the press's ability to cover the president. Well, it's good that they push back, but there's a lot of people in that White House press corps that I would be suspect of to begin with.
Exactly. Now, that they're using the straw man argument that going to be conversations about security matters that the reporters shouldn't have access to. Local reporters who are used to covering a city hall will probably think, wow, they had access to the innards of the White House press operation and thinking that they were beneficiaries of that. You know, we will make the point that here in Albany, reporters used to go up on the second floor where the executive officers were and be able to talk directly to people.
Not anymore.
The access.
Yeah, and that lack of access trickles down to, you know, you could go into City Hall and go into anybody's office, and there's more reticence to allow people to just drop in.
Well, you guys are more seasoned reporters than I am. So how are they going to run into classified information in the West Wing? Mm-hmm. You think they're having those meetings out in the hall? Unless the classified documents that were in Mar-a-Lago are just in a hallway in the West Wing that they can come upon and open boxes and look at. I don't see where that's even a legitimate argument. They're not going to have those discussions there, more likely in a skiff or a private room.
You're relying more on people who are on the inside being willing to leak to you on the outside, but that group of people are being purged.
It seems symbolic to me that they just don't want reporters anywhere near the operation of our federal government.
Because we could find out something that the American people don't like, and they don't want that negative response.
Perhaps Laura Loomer, who can now get into the Pentagon,
she's
going to get special access into the West Wing, too.
Can you believe that they have credentialed her to cover President Trump's Department of Defense as one of the Pentagon press corps? She's agreed to their strict new rules about what she can report and what she can't. She is not a reporter. She is an insider. She is not a reporter. It just further undermines the press operation in Washington, D.C. I mean, we all agree that really good reporters are still going to get good stories about the Pentagon, about the White House, but the day-to-day operation is just hamstrung by this.
As the more legitimate press, like The Hill, NPR, The New York Times, and others, walk out on these rules.
Even Fox walked out on that one.
That's right.
Laura Loomer can walk into Trump's office, apparently, and discuss who should go and who should stay. There's even a term for it. If someone gets loomered, it means that they've been ejected because she has advised the president that they are not loyalist enough. I mean, I have to say that I was listening to some press conference this week where I heard reporters from some of these outlying far-right wing operations ask some legitimate questions. But then you hear them ask questions like, why are you looking so good today, Mr. President?
Why don't people recognize that you really love the American people and are doing the best work anybody's ever done?
Right. And so the fact that the Washington Press Corps remains under attack, further diminished, it just means that the people who run those news operations, the editors at the Washington Post, New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, at CBS, NBC, ABC, MSNBC, they need to do more to lobby this administration to restore the rightful press corps. I mean, who are we to say what's rightful and what's not? But clearly, the people who are in there now, the MyPillow people, are not real journalists.
Well, then you got Caroline Leavitt standing up there as the press secretary.
Chief's assistant.
I saw her responding to the redistricting win for Democrats in California, And she's saying, there's fraud. We know there's fraud. And she was being pushed back on by reporters saying, well, how do you know that? It's just a fact, she said. It's just a fact. She would not explain that, nor will she, nor will even legitimate press get the true answer when it comes to questioning someone like that. And that's just something I think press hasn't been used to.
Yeah, it brings us back to the issue we've talked about repeatedly. How do we deal with the constant flow of misinformation, disinformation, and outright lies from public officials, especially the Trump administration?
Maybe we can solve that next week.
Yeah, good luck with that. Maybe when Rex is back, he'll bring us some clarity on it. Well,
we're out of time.
Believe it or not, that is all the time we have this week.
This show should be 10 minutes.
Thanks to Barbara Lombardo and David Gustina. I'm Judy Patrick. Thanks to all of you for being here. Be sure to join us next week for another edition of The Media Project.
Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include Judy Patrick, former Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
On a living stage now, newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.